Good morning. What a wonderful way to open the invited talk session with a doomsday talk that will tell us about almost the end of the world, or hopefully not. I'm delighted to have Professor Gary Glatzmeyer from UC Santa Cruz here with us today, who's been using computers to run simulations for now a decade or more. Simulations about the behavior of stars and Earth and magnetic cores, and doing actually 3D simulations of those in high enough resolution to tell us some very interesting properties of what's happening. Some of his work has actually gone into experiments that ran on the space shuttle twice already. And a more recent work has to do with the behavior of the magnetic of the Earth, and apparently it's flipping every once in a while. So when this was featured on Nova some time ago, I didn't sleep well that night. I thought, uh-oh. So hopefully we'll hear some more comforting words, and I'm delighted to have Glatzmeyer right here. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm assuming this microphone works. Okay. I'm happy to be here. I thank the organizers for inviting me. I represent the community that uses the computers. We had such a nice keynote discussion or talk this morning, but I've been fortunate enough for actually the last couple decades to have been able to use state of the art computing, or what has been defined as state of the art through those years, and still am. And I use it basically to try to understand the dynamics inside planets and stars, convection and magnetic field generation in general. So what I'll do today is show you some results without going into a lot of detail. Some computer simulation results I've been able to produce over the last several years that help us understand how the fluid flow and heat flow and magnetic field generation occurs inside the Earth's core and inside the interior of the Sun, and also in the interior of Jupiter. Three very, very different environments. And I'm not sure exactly how much detail I'm going to go into. I'll try to stay away from a lot of the mathematics. And, you know, basically, I spend most of my time with the mathematics and the computer programming, getting things to work. And when I give a talk, I just show the nice results that eventually come up from that. But I will try to give you a flavor of what goes into what the type of differential equations that go into this these problems, how they're solved, and then but spend most of the time on the results and show lots of computer graphical movies that nicely show the time dependence of these simulations. So I'm going to start with the Sun. In this, I'm not going to show many simulations here, or maybe none at all. I actually started modeling the Sun when in the late 1970s as a student and as a postdoc, and published several papers in that, and then wandered off into other fields. I modeled the Earth's atmosphere for a while, climate modeling, then got interested in the Earth below the surface, and mantle convection, and the core of the Earth, other planets. And now finally, as I have a graduate student who's sort of bringing me back, she's working on models of the Sun again. So the Sun is nice because it's easy to observe the turbulent convection on the surface of the Sun and the associated magnetic fields. The Earth's core is very hidden from us. We know we can observe very few things about the core. We measure the magnetic field at the surface of the Earth. We measure what happens to a seismic wave that's created by an earthquake and it propagates through the center of the Earth and so we can get some remote sensing, but we don't know what the fluid flow exactly is down there. So it's, you know, trying to understand the interior of the Earth is much more difficult than something that we can actually observe, like on the surface of the sun. So I'm going to start by just showing some images to motivate or show you why I'm motivated by these problems. This is a close-up of the surface of the sun, illustrating the complex convection cells and the associated magnetic fields that are occurring around sunspots. This is the limb of the sun, and this is actually a short movie showing how dynamic the sun really is if you look in the right wavelength. So the ionized plasma follows the structure of the magnetic field that gets generated in the interior of the sun but extends well above the surface of the sun. Here's another example of how violent some of the flares, the solar flares, can be. And the charged particles tend to follow the structure of the magnetic fields, and then as it gives off light, you can see the structure of the field. What's really interesting is that the sun has, or the solar cycle, the solar dynamo produces a magnetic field in the interior of the sun, but it's very cyclic. This is a measure of the solar cycle going back a couple hundred years, and showing how, if you measure the amount of surface area on the sun at a given time, at a given latitude, that's taken up by sunspots. This is basically the measure of that. For example, each slice here, each vertical slice is a year, and it shows what the how much surface area on average was occupied by sunspots at that time for a given latitude. And the different colors represent different polarities. Basically, at one time, the sunspots typically occur in a dipole pair. There's usually one, and there's a leading sunspot and a following sunspot. And in one hemisphere, for example, the northern hemisphere, during a given cycle, the leading spots are all north poles, and the following spots are all south poles in the northern hemisphere, and just the reverse in the southern hemisphere. And it's not just the majority of them, all of them. All of them in the north pole, all the sunspots for that cycle will have that polarity configuration and the reverse polarity configuration in the southern hemisphere. And then, 11 years later, another set of sunspots start being generated that have just the opposite polarity configuration for that 11 years. So this cycle, the actual full cycle, is 22 years to get back to the original magnetic field polarity configuration. This is a signal that is just crying to be explained, and many people have been working on this for many years, and it's still not well understood how the magnetic field is generated, where it's generated, and why you get this cycle. So this is an outstanding problem that needs to be worked on more. Another way of observing or measuring the dynamics in the interior of the sun is to figure out what the rotational profile is. In other words, this region represents the a quadrant of the solar of the sun. The outer part here is convecting. In other words, there's convection going on, and in the interior, it's radiative stable. It's a stable interior. In other words, in this region, heat flux can move out by radiation transfer very effectively. It doesn't need to start moving. But eventually, the opacity becomes large enough that radiation transfer no longer can carry the heat flux. So the heat builds up, and the fluid becomes warm, it expands, becomes buoyant, and finally you get convection. So the heat flux in this region is actually mainly by convective heat flux. So, but it's in this, people believe that it's in this region that most of the magnetic field is generated. It's called the tachocline. And the contours you see here are contours of constant angular velocity relative to the average rotation rate of the sun. And what you're seeing here is that the equatorial region is rotating slightly faster than the rest of the sun, and the rotation rate changes, gets slower and slower as you go to the poles. For example, here the rotational period is on the order of 25 days, and in this latitude it's more like 35 days. So there's a differential rotation, but what we see from the surface is, we can see this, and this has been measured for many years by seeing sunspots move at different rates at different latitudes. But now there's another technology called helioseismology, where the pulsations on the surface of the sun represent seismic waves, and by measuring them very carefully in their frequencies and how the frequencies split because of the rotation, part of one hemisphere is actually moving towards you and the other hemisphere is moving away from you, and the Doppler shift there causes the frequencies to be split a small amount. And it also, in the frequencies, different frequencies sample different depths. I'm not going to go through this in a lot of detail, but there's this whole technology is called helioseismology, and it's a way of trying to get some information about the rotation rate below the surface of the sun as a function of radius and latitude. And that, and the results of that work are displayed here, and it shows that these are basically the contours of constant rotational or constant angular velocity, and they tend to be almost constant on radius until you get to the base of the convection zone, and then the interior appears to be almost rotating in solid body rotation. So one of the outstanding questions today in the solar physics community is why? Why is the interior rotating at almost a constant, you know, solid body rotation rate? Is it a strong magnetic field down there that's locking everything in sync? Or are there gravity waves trying to homogenize the angular momentum? There are various theories out there, back of the envelope theories, and there are people like myself and my grad students and other people who are trying to model this and trying to understand or test the various theories. Just to, before I get into more results, I want to just mention that there's a history of a number of groups around the world that have developed computer simulations, three-dimensional time-dependent computer simulations of convection and also magnetic field generation. Initially, we developed several models just to study the sun. The first one was in the early 1980s, and I produced mine initially in 1984. Another group in the 1990s. So these are basically very similar to atmospheric GCMs, general circulation models, but very deep models. In other words, they're not just surface layers, but the entire interior of the sun. Then in the mid-1990s, I basically modified my solar dynamo model and made a model for the Earth's core. And many other people followed and also developed similar three-dimensional time-dependent computer simulations of convection and magnetic field in the Earth's core to try to understand how the Earth's magnetic field is generated. In other words, the geodynamo. And more recently, we're working on variations to study how magnetic fields are generated in other planets, in particular, giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn. I had a slide here. In fact, I still have it in the presentation at the end, if anybody's interested, showing all the equations in their glory. But then I realized that, you know, I don't like to sit in the audience and try to figure out the person's notation, and, you know, by the time I realize what all the Greek symbols mean, it's over, and I don't get much from it. So I'm going to just sort of explain it to you in words. This is a set of differential equations, nonlinear, three-dimensional, time-dependent differential equations that are all coupled together that need to be solved for these problems. conservation of mass is basically a divergence of mass flux type equation. Mass is not created or destroyed in these problems. Conservation of magnetic flux, there are no magnetic monopoles. An equation of state that relates the various thermodynamic variables. What I normally do is I solve for the entropy perturbation and the pressure perturbation, and then I use an equation of state to go from those variables to a density perturbation. And a density perturbation is really what's going to produce the buoyancy and actually drive the whole system. So you need an equation of state to represent that. And of course, it's going to be very different for the sun and the earth and giant planets. This is Newton's second law of motion. Basically, force is equal to mass times acceleration. And what we're interested in is the acceleration, the time rate of change of velocity. We're trying to understand how velocity, fluid velocity, in three dimensions as a function of time, how that's changing its acceleration. So you find the change in velocity by adding together all the forces. And the forces can be very complicated. Pressure gradient forces, in other words, you have a force going from high pressure to low pressure. Buoyancy, as I mentioned, the fluid heats up, expands, and rises. And then it gets to the surface and cools off, contracts, becomes heavy, and sinks. Very simple concept. This is all represented mathematically. A nonlinear advection term, which means that momentum and heat, for example, are moved from one place to another by the flow itself. Viscous diffusion, Coriolis forces, the fact that we're solving these equations in a rotating frame of reference, in a frame of reference that's rotating with the mean angular velocity of the system, of the sun or the earth. Lorentz forces, the magnetic forces that result whenever you have a current moving perpendicular to a magnetic field, you get another force that's perpendicular to both of those directions. So you add up all these forces at every location in the model, at every time step, and that tells you how the velocity, the fluid velocity at that point and that time changes for that time step. An equation for the magnetic field is based on the Maxwell's equations, basically, but with the approximation that the fluid flow is very small compared to the speed of light. This is an extremely good approximation for all these problems. So it's called the magnetohydrodynamic equations. And there's a nonlinear induction term that describes how magnetic field is generated by the fluid twisting it into other configurations, basically doing work on the magnetic field to generate new magnetic field. And a magnetic diffusion term, basically a macroscopic viewpoint of magnetic reconnection. So you have these two things operating all the time, something trying to generate more magnetic field and something trying to cause it to diffuse away. And the balance will determine the rate of change of the magnetic field in all three directions at that location at that time. All these problems are, the temperature is well above what's called the Curie temperature. So without something continually regenerating the magnetic field, the field would decay away. Different things will decay away at different rates. For the Earth, for example, the Earth's magnetic field, if the core of the Earth would stop convecting, it would take about the half life for the magnetic field would be roughly 15,000 years, which is a very short time compared to the age of the Earth. So there's evidence that the magnetic field has been around for at least 3 billion years, almost in probably the entire 4.5 billion years of the Earth's history. So some process has been around continually regenerating magnetic field to offset its diffusion. There's a heat equation. Basically, the time rate of change of entropy is equal to all the heating terms. Joule heating, basically, if you have a current going through a resisting material, you're going to get, it's going to heat up. Viscous heating, advection, in other words, hot materials being moved around or cold materials being moved around by the flow itself, and thermal diffusion. And then in certain cases, we also have an equation for composition. For example, in the Earth's core, it's not only thermal buoyancy that's driving things, it's a compositional buoyancy that's also, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So you need to follow the two different species, one light and one heavy. And there's an advection term and a diffusion term. So all these equations are written in where you start with a differential equations, and then you decide on a numerical method so that you know how to solve these equations and tell the computer how to do it. And basically, every time step, what is done is first, in my code at least, we advance the magnetic field by knowing what the induction and diffusion terms are from the previous time step. Actually, some of these are done implicitly. And also the heat equation, advancing the entropy and the composition. So if you know the new magnetic field, you can get a new Lorentz force. The new entropy and composition, you get a new buoyancy force. And then you solve this equation for a new pressure and velocity. Once you have the new velocity at the new time step, then you can compute a new induction term here, a new advection here, and advection here. So this equation solved over and over and over. Each time is called one time step. A time step for the Earth's magnetic field, is about on the order of a few days. So things don't change much in one time step, but typically the computer models that I've used will advance the whole solution in three dimensions. Everything changes like maybe 10 days at a time. For the Sun, it's going to be much a shorter period of time. For Jupiter, also a shorter period of time. So it depends on the physics and the dynamics. The numerical method, I could talk for hours on this, but I'll just give you a brief idea of the way I'm doing things. I divide the variables into poloidal, or rather the mass flux, in other words, density times moment, or density times velocity, or the momentum density, and the magnetic field are both divergence free. In other words, there's a divergence of magnetic field that's equal to zero. And I take advantage of that by expanding these two variables in terms of poloidal and toroidal scalar components. In other words, they're expanded in terms of a three-dimensional vector magnetic field can be expanded in terms of two scalar variables that when you take the divergence of this, you get exactly zero. So mathematically, the divergence equations, mass conservation and magnetic flux conservation, are exactly satisfied. And then those variables, these toroidal and poloidal scalar functions that are functions of three dimensions in time, and all the thermodynamic variables, are then expanded in spherical harmonics to represent their horizontal description, you know, latitude and longitude variability, and Chebyshev polynomials in radius. So this is a spectral model opposed to something like a finite difference or a finite volume model. The spectral models are traditionally much more accurate for a given number of grid points or nodes or modes than compared with finite difference, finite element, finite volume models. And so they've been used in the past extensively. However, now with parallel computers, we're running up against a hard wall, because the spectral models require global communication. In other words, if you want to figure out what the value of temperature is at a given location, the coefficients in front of the spherical harmonics, for example, that represent that value, are spread among all the processors. So you have to get information from all the processors just to figure out what something is at a given location. So my code and other codes that use spectral methods have global communication. Every processor has to give and receive information from every other processor every time step. So it's not nearest neighbor communication, which would be much more efficient, in which is the finite difference or finite element models would only need to know the information of the processors around them. And so there's much less communication. So there's an advantage of the spectral method in that it's more accurate. The disadvantage is that it's much less efficient on a parallel system. And so many people are now trying to go back to the simpler methods, like finite volume, finite element, because they can afford to use many, many more nodes or many, many more grid points because the method is simpler, and because they can just use nearest neighbor communication. It's interesting. I use a semi-implicit time integration. Basically, that means that when you advance these equations in time, part of that time derivative is based on what you know at the present time step and the previous time step, and part of it's based on what you will know at the new time step. So you end up, that's called the implicit part of it. In other words, it's more accurate, a little bit more expensive to do, but you end up solving matrices, matrix equations that basically say that the solution that you're getting, the new temperature, for example, the new time step, is going to depend on its spatial derivatives at the new time step and at the old time step. So by breaking up the time derivative between the new and the old, you get more accuracy, but then you pay a bigger price because you're solving large matrix systems. The codes are all parallel using MPI, message passing interface. As I mentioned, they're global communication. I run them on clusters. These are the current computers I'm running on. An IBM computer at NERSC, the Energy Research Institute, DOE's Institute at Berkeley, called Seaborg. There's a compact computer, Alpha computer, at the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center, and I get that support through NSF. I've been running lately, actually since last September, on Columbia, a very fast new computer. It was actually the fastest computer in the world for a month or so last year. This is something like 10,000 processors, SGI processors at NASA Ames. And we have a small Beowulf, well, 240 processor Beowulf computer at Santa Cruz that we were able to get through NSF. And this was initially meant for about five of us, five faculty, to use to do our research. But very quickly, our students and postdocs learned how to write parallel code, and they've basically taken over the entire computer. And I get on it once in a while to do a little bit of code checking or something, but typically I have to go to these other computers off campus to get any real production done. But it's a nice evolution that the students are able to, you know, they very quickly see the benefits of parallel computing and they very quickly jump on the machine. This, before I get into any of the problems I've already mentioned, I want to show a short movie on an experiment that I was involved with the space shuttle back in 1985, and then we flew it again in 1995. This is a small, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but it's a small hemisphere about the size of a tennis ball, and it's a shell, and there's convection, there's a fluid oil flow on the outside of the shell, and it's heated on the inside and cooled on the outside, and it's on a turntable that rotates. And the whole idea was to try to get some experimental fluid dynamics done in spherical geometry with a radial gravity. Well, the gravity is really not gravity, it's really an electrostatic force. Potential difference is placed between the outer and inner boundaries, and you get an electrostatic force that's radial then, and then you put it on a turntable. So this was flown on space shuttle in a microgravity environment. So the reason it was done on the space shuttle was to be able to do it outside the influence of the Earth's gravity, basically, because this little potential, this electrostatic force, is very small compared to the Earth's gravity. So to be able to see this small radial force, we had to fly it on the shuttle. So what you'll see first is some movies that were taken in 1985. This was recorded on film, actually, during the flight, of shadow graph images of this convection. And it'll be a circular image. It's circular because the port camera was looking through was circular. So, but the bottom part is actually the equatorial plane, and the top part is the pole. Let's see. So the equator's down here, and the pole's up here, and you see these waves that are moving in that direction in general, and up here in the opposite direction. It jumps because We would run it for a while and then change things and run it back. So this is a concatenation of many different series. This is a computer simulation I did of that back in the 1980s. And I was trying to use my model to simulate the experiment. And what happened right there is I instantaneously increased the vigor of convection. But in general, got patterns that are very similar to what we saw in the experiment. Waves moving in this direction at low latitude and in the opposite direction at high latitude. This is pretty poor resolution graphically. And the reason is that initially, I produced this on 16 millimeter film when I was at Los Alamos. I spent 16 years at Los Alamos and then the last 6 or 7 at the University of California in Santa Cruz. But in those days, the way you made movies is you made them on 16 millimeter film. And I remember, especially when I was a postdoc, I didn't have a lot of seniority, so I could only make about this much film, length of film, every day. So I'd make this much, and then I'd keep splicing it together before, by the time I had a nice long movie. So I used to show this movie, but you had to rely on the other institutions to have a movie projector. And then that sort of fell by the wayside. So I finally copied the 16 millimeter film onto a video and showed that for many years. And then more recently copied the video onto a digital recording. So every time I changed the graphical interface, I lost resolution. Let me talk a little bit about the Earth's core. Just to bring everybody up to speed, remind people what the interior of the Earth looks like. The outer, roughly the outer half in radius is the mantle. And in this problem, I'm not computing that area. I'm assuming it's an insulator. Compared to the core of the Earth has got two different regions, an outer fluid core and an inner solid core. And both regions are mainly iron, with a small concentration of other elements that are really still not known, probably sulfur, oxygen, but the actual composition is not known, other than the fact that there are lighter elements in here than pure iron. So the idea is, as the Earth cools off, the warm fluid rises because it's buoyant, and then it cools, and then it sinks. So you have convection, because thermal conduction is not efficient enough to transfer the heat from the interior to the outer part of the core. And the heat here then is convected by mantle convection at a very much slower pace. The time for convection to move from here to here, like one turnover, is typically about 100 years or a few hundred years. The fluid is only moving about 1 millimeter per second. But that's fast compared to the convection in the mantle, which is about a million times slower than that. So here are a typical turnover time in the mantle. For example, tectonic plates will sink to the bottom, and then eventually plumes will come up. That time scale is on the order of hundreds of millions of years. But the idea is that as the fluid moves, the viscosity of the fluid is very low. It's probably as small as water, even though the density is about 10 times the density of water. But because it's a very low viscosity fluid, the rotation rate of the Earth plays a major role. There are Coriolis forces. So the fluid doesn't just rise in a straight line, it actually rises in a very curved trajectory because of Coriolis forces. And this curved trajectory of the fluid, of an electrically conducting metal, causes the magnetic field to be generated. It's basically, if you have an existing magnetic field and then you twist that magnetic field, you do work on it and generate a new magnetic field. Or another way of looking at this is that whenever you have a conducting material moving through an existing magnetic field, it's going to produce Lorentz forces that generate an electric current. It's the same principle that operates an electric generator. Dynamo is just a British name for electric generator. So you have fluid, electrically conducting material moving through a magnetic field, generating strong electric currents, and every electric current has another magnetic field associated with it, around it. And the idea, the back of the envelope idea that's been around for a century, is that somehow the flow must be very special in order to regenerate a magnetic field that has the same polarity as the existing magnetic field. This process has to keep compensating for the fact that the field at the same time is diffusing away. The time scale, like I said, the half-life for the magnetic field in the Earth is about 15,000 years. So something has to keep regenerating it. And then when it gets to the surface, it looks very much like a dipole. These are, you know, schematic magnetic field lines. They're just a graphical illustration of what the direction of the magnetic field is. And so at the surface, we see a nice dipole structure. And currently, the magnetic field is directed inwards at the north geographic pole and outwards at the south geographic pole. That's called the normal magnetic polarity, what we've had for almost 800,000 years now. But in the past, it's been seen that reverse polarity has existed from time to time. And it's, in other words, it's also dipolar, but now the field is directed outwards. So this is actually a north magnetic pole and the south magnetic pole. What we have today is a south magnetic pole at the north geographic pole, by definition. So one of the questions that's been around for a long time is, first of all, how is the magnetic field of the Earth always being regenerated? How is it being maintained? What type of fluid flows is occurring in the fluid core that keeps regenerating the magnetic field and makes it look pretty much like a dipole most of the time? And why does it occasionally, on the order of every couple hundred thousand years or so, does it actually go through a magnetic field reversal? So these are questions that we set out to try to understand by making a computer simulation, three-dimensional time-dependent computer simulation of this, and seeing what it would do, and hoping that we could get a magnetic field that would look something like the Earth's. And we were fortunate enough to be able to get a magnetic field that looks a lot like the Earth's, and something that we hadn't even dreamed of is that we finally get some magnetic field reversals, spontaneous reversals. The simulation eventually went through a number of reversals at roughly the right time scale and frequency. This is an example. This is a record of magnetic field reversals that have occurred in the Earth. This is the present time, backwards millions of years, back to 160 million years. This mainly comes from the ocean floor. For example, the mid-Atlantic is spreading. The ocean is spreading apart, the ocean floor. And as the new floor comes up, it's warm. And as it cools below the Curie temperature, it captures the direction and the intensity of the magnetic field at that location at that time. So what people found was that as you go further and further away from that, the mid-Atlantic ridge, you see magnetic fields in different directions, and the pattern is mirrored on each side. And that was the first indication that the field actually underwent reversals. So this shows the record that the dark regions are normal polarities and the white are reverse polarities. You can also tell that the time between reversals is not constant. It's not nice and periodic like the sun's. And there's been long periods of time, tens of millions of years, during which there apparently were not any reversals or any successful reversals. In addition, this is a plot of the same thing, but only out to the last 3.8 million years. This is the current polarity. Almost 800,000 years ago was when the last reversal was. However, there have been several attempts, these are called events, when it looked like the field tried to reverse and then came right back again and wasn't successful. But what's being plotted here is the intensity, the magnetic dipole intensity as a function of time. And it goes up and down a lot, but whenever there is a reversal, it's very low. So typically when there is a reversal, the intensity is very small, but not the converse. Many times the intensity gets very, very small, and then you think it might reverse, but it builds up again. The original polarity comes back. So these are some of the measured observations that we set out to try to explain. This is a snapshot, one of my snapshots of my my initial computer simulations of the dynamo, of the Earth's magnetic field. This is the top of the core. The inner core is about here. The surface of the Earth is about out here. And these are magnetic field lines, just one set. Magnetic field lines are just, I remember, just a graphical illustration of a three-dimensional vector field. And the lines here, blue represents inward directed field, and the gold represents outward directed field. So the color just tells you what the direction of the radial component of the magnetic field is. So outside the core, we see a nice dipole structure. Inside the core, it's much more complicated, much more intense. This is where the fluid is actually twisting the magnetic field and generating new magnetic field. And also, if you look carefully, you sort of see a structure here, a cylindrical structure. This is the rotation axis. It turns out there's a large shear flow on this, what's called a tangent cylinder, an imaginary cylinder that's tangent to the inner core boundary. And fluid dynamically, it turns out that the outer part of this region wants to rotate at one velocity, and the inner part wants to rotate at another velocity. And so right at this boundary, there's a large velocity shear, which tends to twist the magnetic fields and generate more magnetic field. Here's a short simulation or a short movie that gives you a better idea of the structure of this three-dimensional structure of this solution. This is where the surface of the Earth would be. This is the top of the core. So all the action is occurring inside the core. Now I'm letting the camera go through and giving you a little better view of the three-dimensional structure of this field. This is just one time step. This is one snapshot in the time-dependent simulation. And now the camera is going to go right through. This is a nice way of actually seeing the structure of the field inside the fluid core and nice smooth structure inside the solid inner core. So solid inner core is could be rotating, but there's no field generated in the solid inner core because there's no shearing occurring there. The shearing only occurs in the fluid core above the solid inner core. So here again, you see the stretched out magnetic field lines in the fluid core, and then a smooth field inside the solid inner core. The field just diffuses into the solid inner core. One way to see how well this computer simulation compares with the Earth is to compare it to the magnetic field. This is the magnetic field for the Earth in the year 1980. This is what it would look like at the surface of the Earth. This is an equal area projection, North Pole, North Geographic Pole, South Pole, the equator's through the center. So this is the entire surface of the Earth. And again, the colors mean the same thing as they did in the three-dimensional image. Blue represents inward-directed magnetic field, and yellow represents outward-directed magnetic field. So the fact that most of the southern hemisphere here is yellow and most of the northern hemisphere is blue is just the dipole part, the dipole signature of the field. Now, it's not a perfect dipole, but at the surface of the Earth, it's pretty close. If we take this information and project it down to the core of the Earth, so just mathematically project it down to the core of the Earth, assuming that the mantle is an insulator. Well, the mantle isn't a perfect insulator, but it's such a poor conductor compared to the core that you can make that approximation. So when you do that mathematically, you get much more detailed structure of the magnetic field. You still see the dipole structure, but it's not as dominant at the top of the core, the core mantle boundary, as it is at the surface. Also, the intensity of the field at that surface is about 10 times the intensity it is at the surface of the Earth. So, but this is only plotted out to spherical harmonic degree 12. It's not that we can't measure it more accurately than that. It's measured much more accurately by satellites now. But the problem is once you get to a degree larger than 12 or so, in other words, length scales smaller than that, you get magnetic field structures that are coming from the crust of the Earth, not the core of the Earth. This is presumably from the core of the Earth. But when you get down to a small enough scale, the signal coming from the core is completely overwhelmed by the signal you have in permanent magnetism in the crust of the Earth. So unfortunately, we can't see much more detail than this from the surface of the Earth. Now, what people are trying to do is, if you measure this over a long period of time and pick out what parts are changing with time, the parts that are changing slowly are probably coming from the core of the Earth, whereas the parts that are not are probably from the crust of the Earth. So there's hope that in the future we'll be able to get much more detail by isolating the smaller structures that are actually changing with time. But if I compare this to one of my computer simulations, but also plot it out only to degree 12, qualitatively you get something very similar. And I'm not trying to get it exactly the same, because I don't know what the initial conditions are. I don't know what the flow structure is inside the core. All I'm trying to do is qualitatively get some agreement. It's the same thing as the difference between climate modeling and weather prediction. Weather prediction, they both use three-dimensional general circulation models, but weather prediction tries to use all the current information about the weather, temperature, humidity, clouds, everything all over the globe, and try to predict a few days ahead of time. Whereas climate modeling isn't interested in knowing what the temperature and weather prediction is. It does a simulation for maybe years at a time and tests things like global warming. What will happen if you increase the carbon dioxide concentration? And you're not interested in the exact prediction. What you're interested in is understanding what will happen qualitatively. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to understand qualitatively how does the Earth's magnetic field get generated, and what qualitative flows are occurring in the core of the Earth, which we can't detect. If I take the same solution at the same time step and plot it out to degree 95, I get much more structure at the core, at the top of the core, in very small concentrations of magnetic flux. These are sort of similar to the sunspots that are seen on the surface of the sun. The sunspots are basically very high concentrations of magnetic field. And so we suspect something similar occurs probably in the Earth's core and in the structure. In other words, what we see from measurements is probably a very, very filtered, smoothed projection of what really might exist at the top of the core. The computer simulations also tell us what's happening inside the core. These are longitudinally averaged profiles of the density. The dotted contours represent density of the fluid that's less than the average. So there's a little bit higher density out here, but lower density inside the polar regions. The reason this occurs is the convection is less efficient inside the poles. I won't go through all the reasons for that, but because of the spherical geometry and the relationship between gravity, the direction of gravity, and in the direction of rotation, it's more efficient to transport heat from here to there than it is from there to there. This actually has to spiral around and then change direction as it gets to the surface. So this stays warmer than this does. So this means that this is buoyant, and so fluid tends to rise and go out this way and come in this direction. Well, when the fluid is coming in this direction, the moment of inertia of the fluid parcels is decreasing. In other words, it's getting closer to the axis of rotation. This is a plot of the angular velocity relative to the average angular velocity of the rotating planet. The solid contours represent regions that are rotating eastward, in other words, faster than the average, and the broken contours westward. So as the fluid comes in this direction, it's losing, it's decreasing its moment of inertia, and therefore its angular velocity increases. Partial conservation of angular momentum, just like a skater who's spinning and she brings in her arms, she starts spinning faster. The same type of thing is happening in the model. The fluid comes in and starts spinning faster. And then when it rises and moves away, it spins westward again. But the magnetic field that goes through both the fluid here and solid inner core tends to drag the inner core with it, with the fluid above it. So what we found in the simulations back in 1995 was that the inner core in a model, which is free to rotate in any direction it wants to at whatever rate, depending on what torque is on it, tended to always be rotating a little bit faster than the surface or the core or the mantle because of this effect. The fluid above the inner core was rotating eastward, in other words, a little bit faster than most of it, and the magnetic field was penetrating through both the fluid and the solid inner core and basically pulling it along, just like a motor. And so I wrote this in a few sentences in a paper, in a Nature paper in 1995, not thinking that anybody would ever be able to detect that, but I just thought it was something interesting. Well, a number of seismologists at Columbia University read this paper, and they've been working with seismic waves that travel through the core of the Earth, seismic waves generated by earthquakes in the southern hemisphere and detected in Alaska. And for over 30 years, they've been measuring the travel times between waves that go actually through the solid inner core and waves that just pass through the fluid core. And there was a difference in travel time. And they noticed that over 30 years, there's a slight change in that difference. Well, without going into the details, they backed out from that information that the inner core was actually rotating slightly faster than the surface and very close to what we predicted. So it was a nice example of a computer simulation that, you know, I was not looking for this. I assume the inner core wasn't completely stationary, but no one really thought it was actually persistently moving eastward, and not at that rate. But I mentioned it, somebody else in a completely different field in seismology picked it up, and now it's sort of grown into a whole community on its own, trying to figure out the super rotation of the inner core. This is a small portion of one of my computer simulations in terms of 20,000 years. And it shows the rate that the inner core is moving relative to the mantle. And it varies a lot with time, but there's a eastward drift. The positive value here means it's rotating eastward slightly faster than the surface of the Earth. But there are times when it's actually rotating slower, but most of the time faster. But it varies, and the time scale for variation is on the order of 50 years. So it's a very dynamic, something that's a short enough time scale that you know, we can appreciate it in our lifetime. So there's a lot of people trying to continually measure this over more and more years and hopefully pin down what the rotation rate of the inner core is at the moment. On a much longer time scale, now we're talking about hundreds of thousands of years, the computer simulation has, as I mentioned, actually gone through spontaneous magnetic field reversals. And this is an example of a simulation, a 300,000-year simulation, where this shows the magnetic pole as a function of latitude. This is the equator, north geographic pole. And the south magnetic pole is wandering around here. It's time-dependent. And then within a relatively short period of time, it jumps and reverses and then stays in this polarity for a long time. And the time here is typically, you know, the ballpark time that's been seen in the Earth's paleomagnetic reversal record, on the order of a few hundred thousand years between reversals. Although the last one was 800,000 years, so that's longer than the average. And then again, it jumps back up again. This looks like it's almost instantaneous, but from here to here was something like 30,000 numerical time steps. So there's something like several million numerical time steps were required to do this simulation. This actually took several years of my life, submitting jobs to these big computers. Typically, the queue would be 6 or 12 hours a day. So every day, I'd submit a job, and at the end of the day, see what the results were. Hopefully, the computer didn't crash. Get those results, make them be the input for the next day, and do this day after day after day, 7 days a week, no matter where I was. If I were on vacation, my wife would not like the idea that I was, logging in every night. Or if I was, in a hotel one night, anyway, I had to do this for actually about 4.5 years. In several different simulations, but it all paid off. We finally got some nice long simulations of a nice magnetic field evolution. And just to show you an example, this is going to show a magnetic field reversal. What you're looking at here is the plot of the magnetic field, the radial component, at the top of the core, not the surface, but at the core mantle boundary. And as before, the blue represents inward-directed magnetic field, and the red and yellow represents outward. The equator is right through the center, north geographic pole, south geographic pole. And this simulation will this movie will span about 200,000 years. And there's a drift, there's a sort of a pulsation, but there also seems to be a drift to the west. This has also been observed. It's called the westward drift in the Earth's magnetic field, especially over Africa in the last couple hundred years. There's a structure over Africa that tends to be drifting to the west. In a moment now, that I'm going to speed this up. The movie's going to speed up by a factor of 6, just so we can get through 200,000 years in a reasonable amount of time. But what you're going to see is, as it speeds up, there will be several attempts for this to reverse. So this is a time-dependent simulation. You just keep running it and running it. Never know when it's going to, what it's going to do, or if it's going to reverse. Sort of has a life of its own. Again, the yellow in the southern hemisphere and the blue in the northern hemisphere is a dipole signature. And sometimes that degrades, and you get less of a dipole and almost an indication that it might try to reverse. So what I've seen from these simulations is that the solution is always trying to do something. There's all these instabilities, hydrodynamic, magnetohydrodynamic instabilities, always trying to reverse, but typically not succeeding. You know, it looks very non-dipole structure. Now the field's getting weak. You might think it is a good time for it to reverse, but typically it reverts back to its original polarity. Again, you get more and more red up here. That would indicate reverse flux patches. We're starting to see something like that in the Earth's current magnetic field, where you have red here where the background normally is blue. In other words, outward directed field. Right now the field's going to reverse it, right? Right now. Okay, that was the reversal. So we're just seeing what's happening at the top of the core. All the action is actually occurring below this surface. So now you have magnetic field directed outwards in the northern hemisphere and inwards in the southern hemisphere. Now it's going to try to reverse back, but it's not going to succeed, at least not in this movie. What I'm going to do now is actually show you that reversal again at the slower speed. And I'm going to show it to you what it looks like, not only at the core mantle boundary, but what it looks like at the surface of the Earth. So this is the same simulation, but only about, I think it's 7,000 years around that one reversal that occurred. And it'll be at the slower speed. So what you've seen before will look like this. And I made it smaller because it's at a smaller radius. So this is actually the relative sizes. So this is what the field would look like at the surface of the Earth. This is at the top of the core. Again, this is just during that one reversal. So you see a nice dipole structure that's time dependent at the surface of the Earth, and then just happens you get a very complicated dipole structure, equatorial, and then the reversal. Now what I'm going to do, so what you're seeing is only the top of the core. I'm going to show you the same reversal again, but what it looks like inside the core. However, I'm not going to show you the three-dimensional structure. I'm going to average everything in longitude to make the graphics a little simpler. And in addition, this side of the plot is different than this side. This side will represent magnetic field lines, and the blue, or the green here, represents clockwise directed magnetic field. So when it reverses, it'll change color and become counterclockwise in yellow. So this side of the plot represents the poloidal magnetic field, the radial and latitudinal components of the field. This side of the plot, so this is, you know, this is the core, the fluid core, this is solid inner core. This side represents the other component, the east and west component of the magnetic field, the toroidal part. The yellow, these are contours now. The yellow represents eastward directed magnetic field, so into the screen. and the blue represents contours that are westward, in other words, coming out at you. So you'll see all three components at the same time. Again, most of the magnetic field is in the fluid core, and especially at the interface between the fluid and the solid inner core. And the field will diffuse into the solid inner core, but it's generated out here. And it will be a little bit smoother than it really is because we're averaging everything in longitude. But still you see a time dependence, even in the longitude and the average field. But typically you have this nice dipole structure. And then every once in a while, the fluid flow will be like a storm that will, fluid will change its direction and twist the magnetic field in a different direction and cause instabilities that typically will die away. For example, here you have an instability that almost dies away, but for some reason the flow structure continues to build this up, and the original polarity is decaying away. And now if you're sitting on the surface of the Earth, you'd say, oh, the field's been reversed, but it still takes another few thousand years for the original polarity to diffuse out of the inner core and the new polarity to actually work its way down and diffuse into the inner core. And at the same time, the direction of the east-west components of the field reverses. Now this is just one reversal, and they all seem to be a little bit different. Some start at the inner core boundary, some at the outer core. They take different amounts of time. It's usually a competition between the new polarity and the old polarity. Typically the original polarity is the one that wins out because it's locked into the inner core, or it's at least takes longer for it to diffuse out. So it has the advantage, and that's probably why you see lots in the Earth's magnetic field reversal record. You see events that are trying to reverse, but typically it doesn't. It's only once in many, many attempts does a reversal, a full reversal actually happen. Let me switch to a different topic here, and I'll look at giant planets, gas planets, planets like Jupiter. This is fun. This is a movie taken by Voyager many years ago as it approached Jupiter, and you see the structures of the band, the belts and zones, different clouds on Jupiter. But in addition, the winds, especially in the equatorial region, are blowing eastward. In other words, there's a differential rotation, a very complicated differential rotation on Jupiter, more complicated than it is on the Sun. On the Sun, you just have the equator moving faster than the poles. Here you have the equator moving very fast, and then a region where it's moving slower, another region is moving fast, and back and forth. There's a very banded structure in the rotation profile that's seen on the surface of Jupiter. Likewise, there's a banded structure on Saturn in the rotational structure. This is why I was talking about, if you plot, this is for Jupiter, if you plot as a function this south pole and the north pole, in function of latitude, what the angular velocity is as a function of latitude, you see that near the equator you have a very strong eastward flow, and then there's a westward flow, and then an eastward flow, westward, eastward, westward, all the way up to the poles in both directions. And something similar on Saturn, although Saturn's equatorial jet is much wider and stronger, goes up to almost 500 meters per second compared to on the order of 100 meters per second on Jupiter. This is again relative to the average rotation rate on the surface. So this is something that we're interested in trying to understand for the giant planets. This is one of the attempts, recent attempts of mine to do a dynamo for Jupiter, where you're starting to see magnetic field being wrapped around in bands. On top of that, you have a nice dipole structure, but a lot of magnetic field energy at latitudes that are far from the equator. This is very, very preliminary. If you look inside and do an average in longitude for this Jupiter simulation, you see here the yellow means it's rotating faster than the average. In other words, it's an eastward rotation relative to the average mean rotation. And blue is westward. So you're starting to see a banded structure in the simulation. And this is a pattern of the radial component of the magnetic field, similar to what you just saw. In other words, very strong outward magnetic field in the southern hemisphere and inward magnetic field in the northern hemisphere. If you look in the equatorial plane, you see flow structure in the eastward direction near the outer part and in the westward direction in the inner part. I should mention that I'm only simulating the outer part here of Jupiter in this case. Sometimes I go right to the center, but it's the outer part is, well, roughly at this radius, there's a phase transition. The hydrogen actually goes from a molecular type hydrogen in the outer part to a more metallic type hydrogen in the inner part. So the electrical conductivity changes significantly, becomes much larger below this region. And it's believed that that strong magnetic field as a result of that high electrical conductivity is going to keep things in more solid body rotation below here, just as it seems to be doing in the sun. On the surface, I'm seeing, this is a plot of the longitudinal, well, actually the longitudinal velocity. I'm seeing a very strong eastward flow at the equator, and then westward, and then eastward, westward, eastward. So something similar to what is being seen on Jupiter, although not as many bands yet. And also a similar profile in the temperature, surface temperature. So it's encouraging, but it's not there yet. To summarize some of these things, I want to say that there are many differences between these three different problems, the Earth, Jupiter, and the Sun. Certainly the dimension, the mass, rotation rate, equation of state, heat flux, force balance, and energy balance, differential rotation, magnetic records. These are all different, different time scales, maybe a little bit different places where they're occurring. But there may be some similarities too. For example, the toroidal field in the Earth, in the model for the Earth, tends to be generated mostly at the bottom of the fluid core, at the interface between the inner fluid core and the solid inner core, because there you have a lot of shear occurring, the tangent cylinder effect I mentioned. And in the Sun, at the base of the convection zone is where, again, you have a lot of shear, which has been inferred or observed from helioseismology. And most people think that's where most of the magnetic field is generated also. The inner part of the Sun is not solid. It's still fluid, but it tends to be rotating in a solid body rotation. So again, it's the place where you have very strong shear flow is where the magnetic field is probably being generated. And in Jupiter, it might be the interface between the hydrogen, metallic hydrogen in the interior and molecular hydrogen in the outer region. So there might be some similarities. The problem with all these computer simulations is that we can't afford to do them at as high a spatial resolution as we'd like to. All the simulations, in order to maintain numerical stability, we have to use diffusivities that are much, much larger than they should be. Viscous diffusivity, thermal diffusivity, magnetic diffusivity. They're all representing the effect of small-scale turbulence that we can't resolve in the model. And they're not really representing the molecular motions, which are orders of magnitude smaller coefficients than what we have in the model. So this is something, this is true for climate modeling. I mean, when people do climate modeling, they don't put in the viscosity of air. Or ocean modeling circulations, you don't put in the viscosity of water. You put in a viscosity that's representing the turbulence that you can't see in the model. Because that turbulence is much more effective in transporting heat and momentum and anything than the molecular motions. So it's a very, very crude way of representing something you're not seeing because you can't afford the resolution. But it's very crude, and as a result, the simulations, these all the examples I've shown you so far are not what I would call strong turbulence. They're very time dependent, they're chaotic, but they're laminar flows, very smooth laminar flows. Plumes tend to stretch from the bottom boundary to the top boundary, not isolated turbulence. And that's a real problem, and this is a real challenge for the future, to be able to get better numerical methods and faster computers in order to be able to resolve the turbulence, because things may be very, very different. The type of flows you get in turbulent flow is very different than laminar flow. And I want to demonstrate that in a couple two-dimensional simulations. So what I'm going to do from now on is show you a number of two-dimensional simulations of strongly turbulent flow, or contrast turbulent flow with laminar flow. Reason I'm doing it in 2D is because we can afford to do it in 2D. For example, this simulation has 2,000 grid points in this direction and 4,000 in this direction. It's much more than we need for this simulation, but the future ones you'll see require that resolution. This is an example of just a simple thermal convection problem. It's heated at the bottom boundary. Gravity is downwards. It's cooled at the top boundary. The side boundaries are periodic. The reds and yellows represent warm, buoyant fluid, fluid that's expanded and become buoyant, it's rising. And then it cools at the surface in a color of blue when it's heavy and cold, and it sinks. So I'll show you this very quick simulation. So this is characteristic of the three-dimensional simulations I've shown you so far. It's time-dependent, it's interesting, but these plumes are very large. You know, they stretch from one boundary to another. And that's a characteristic of laminar flow, not turbulence. This is sort of like a lava lamp, where the oil is heated, and you get nice convective structures, but it's not turbulent. I'll contrast that with a turbulent simulation. Here in this case, I'm doing a simulation where I've reduced the viscous diffusion coefficient by a factor of 1,000 and the thermal diffusion coefficient by a factor of 1,000. Effectively, that's increasing the convective driving by a factor of 1,000,000 compared to the previous movie. So other than that, everything else is essentially the same. And I should also mention that now I also have rotation. There's a rotation axis perpendicular to this plane and a background magnetic field. The magnetic field is going to try to resist. The fluid's going to try to move through the magnetic field. Whenever it tries to do that, the magnetic field will resist that. And the magnetic field will act like an elastic medium. You push in one direction, and it'll try to push you back in the other direction. And so you get these waves, Alphane waves, you'll see simulated here. So it'll be a combination of convection and wave motion when you reduce the diffusivities enough. So you can see that you get this shivering effect. That's due to the magnetic field, the magnetic field waves, and you also get the convection on top of that. This is very different than the previous movie. I mean, and if you analyze this in detail, the energy spectra, where the temperature profiles that evolve, you get a very turbulent boundary layer. There are so many things different in this simulation compared to the others. And all I did basically, well, the other one had magnetic field in too, but basically what I did is I reduced the diffusivities and was able to resolve much smaller scale turbulence. Here's another simulation where I am also, I have a large density stratification, the density at the bottom. This is more, the previous two cases were more like for the Earth's core, where the variation was only 20% different. The density at the bottom was 20% larger than the density at the top. This is similar to how density varies in the Earth's fluid core. This one varies by about 150. The density here is about 150 times larger than it is up there. So this is more like what you'd expect in a giant planet. I'm also going to start this simulation at the initial condition. Here, the warm regions are the light. So this is warm, this is cold. And this shows the initial perturbation. But you'll see how this starts initially as large plumes, and then because the diffusion coefficients are so small, you get lots of small-scale turbulence. And you get a simulation that looks, you know, looks fairly realistic in terms of what would happen if you had a fluid that has a very low viscosity. And you get small vortices that last for a long time. And you get waves at the surface. So these are all things that are very different from the laminar simulations that we're only able to do in three dimensions. Here's another case. This is actually, I've got a number of graduate students who are sort of caught the bug of doing numerical simulations, and they're writing their own codes in parallel and investigating various problems for their thesis research. One student is interested in the sun, the interior of the sun, as I mentioned, and the interior of the sun, the outer part is convective, as I talked about at the beginning of the talk, and the inner part is radiative, in other words, stable. This is a case where it's just slightly stable, not like the sun, but it's just slightly stable. And you can see what happens. and you get this initial perturbation, heavy stuff drops in, and then it finds itself buoyant, you know, and you get lots of entrainment and lots of turbulence. You start getting convection in this region, but these perturbations tend to rise eventually. This is one of her initial simulations, and then we went back, and she decided to increase the stability of the lower region. This is more like the sun. And now what happens is you get strong turbulent or strong convection in this region, but you get gravity waves here. The gravity waves, which are excited by the penetrating convection. So gravity waves occur when the fluid moves and it finds itself heavier, or when it moves up and it finds itself heavier, then the surroundings comes down. When it moves down and finds itself lighter and goes up. So if it moves, there's a restoring force. Whereas in convection region up here, if it moves, it continues to move up. It's always, in other words, it's based on what the background temperature profile is, if it's super adiabatic or sub adiabatic. Here's another one of my students who's more interested in the interior of giant planets, and in particular planets that don't have inner cores. Now the methods I've used are spectral methods, and I have a coordinate origin at the center, so it's very difficult to remove that core numerically. So what she's done is a totally different numerical method, a finite volume method, basically going back to a simpler method, but one that does not have problems simulating the entire interior of a planet. This is her initial perturbation. So this shows that when you remove the core, you get flow going right through the center, at least in this parameter regime. So she's mainly interested in what are called extrasolar planets, giant planets that are going around other stars, not the sun. And there's still a discussion about Jupiter. Does Jupiter actually have an inner core? Some models say it does, and others say it doesn't. So, and here's another example of one of her simulations with a stable inner core. So you get a very different type of flow pattern when you have that inner core. I've got so many movies, I'm going to show you a few and then move on. This is another one of my models at a higher resolution, showing, this is in the equatorial plane, showing the type of flow structures you can get when you lower the viscosity and thermal conductivity. But this is a case without rotation, it's just convection. In the next case, I'll show you two short movies where you, in addition, have the effect of Coriolis forces, and you get a very different flow pattern. So this is similar, a little bit different color diagram, but now with effective Coriolis forces, you get a very spiral type flow structure. You have turbulence, but on top of a very large scale spiral. And you can find that if you change the density structure, you can get the spiral to go in the opposite direction. So it depends on actually how density varies with radius. It's basically the second derivative of density, and you get a spiral in the opposite direction. So this is sort of something I'm investigating to try to understand why, for example, on Jupiter, some latitudes are rotating one direction, other latitudes in other direction. Finally, this one. This is another one of my students, one working on the sun, convection in the outer region and gravity waves in the center. I think this is the last one I want to show. Yes. Just to summarize, the challenge for the next generation of global dynamo models is to go to higher spatial resolution in three dimensions. And so you're able to lower the diffusivities, lower viscosity and thermal conductivity in particular. which will allow you to actually simulate turbulent flow or gravity waves in stable regions, or in phase transitions, for example, in Jupiter. And this is going to require better numerical methods and subgrid scale models. You know, we're never going to be able to get to the small enough diffusion coefficients that we want. And so we need something, some better set of subgrid scale models to represent the small scale turbulence that we're always missing. Thank you. I think we have a few minutes for questions.
Okay, it works. Sorry, I have to ask you that you're solving nonlinear differential equations, and you're solving initial value problems, so you don't have anything, you know, any boundary up there, and you do it for very long time steps. And the equations are nonlinear and unstable, as you noticed. So the question becomes, during your simulation, you have lots of sources of errors, like approximation errors, you use finite difference for derivatives, you have, you know, approximation in different spectral series, and you have round-off errors. So it means all these errors, because you don't have a boundary, they keep accumulating, and especially in unstable region, equations are unstable, they tend to have a very large effects. So how do you guard that? How do you actually know that these are transitions, physical transitions rather than numerical transitions?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are so many approximations and errors at every level. The first level is that writing down the equations, we're not including all the physics that we should. So the equations themselves, even the differential equations, before you do anything with them, are approximations, because we're leaving some things out that we think are small. For example, the precession rate of the Earth is not in this model, and some people think that might be important. So there's that level. Then you take those equations and use a numerical method, spectral or finite difference. That's going to have inherent errors or inconsistencies. And then you put it on a computer, and then there's a truncation error. Every time step, you're throwing away. Every time you take a nonlinear term, you, for example, if you have 1,000 spherical harmonics representing each variable and multiplying together, you should have twice as many at least that next time step. Well, you can't keep doubling the number of spherical harmonics every time step. So you throw away information every time step. So everywhere, every time you do this, you have approximations. But the thing is, we're not, even the initial conditions are not sacred. We don't know what the initial conditions are. We're just putting something in. We run it for a long time until we think it no longer cares what the initial conditions were. So we're not trying to solve mathematically exactly the solution. What we're trying to do is learn, and we're hoping that there's all these little differences that you get. If you ran it on a different computer with a different accuracy word, you get a slightly different solution. They wouldn't track each other exactly, for example. But we're not interested in exactly predicting something. We're more interested in seeing a qualitative feature. In other words, we're seeing if the solution actually does reverse. And when it does reverse, can we learn something from that? But you're right. It's the butterfly effect. There's no way we're going to be able to solve these equations perfectly, but we don't want to do that either. It's just we're trying to use a tool and trying to learn from a tool. The point of my talk was that even though we're getting solutions that are starting to look fairly realistic for the Earth and for the Sun and for Jupiter, I know that there are so many uncertainties in the way these things are modeled, because we're not even getting close to resolving three-dimensional turbulence. And so it actually surprises me that the solutions look as realistic as they do. So all we can do, I can say, is we do what we can with the computers we have today and try to hopefully learn what we can and keep improving things in the future. As the computer's hardware increases, improves, and we improve our numerical methods, hopefully we can do better and better in the future. And see, 10 years from now, we can look back and say, well, how good were those solutions? How good were our ideas at that time? Were we on the right track? Or we might find, we were completely wrong.
That brings to the follow-up, and that's you mentioned turbulence. Turbulence is notoriously difficult because of that. It's a highly unstable system. And It seems to me, to investigate these high-end sable systems and even to understand qualitative behavior of them, and even to know if, this qualitative behavior is the function of the equation, so the function of the equations plus the, the solving procedure, and what is the, contribution of the solving procedure. It seems to be the, progress, the big progress would occur not in improving like better computers and higher grid scale and other things, but in improving the analytical methods, maybe using symbolic algebra to understand it. Because maybe you're just lucky that you have, a coarse grid, because things are averaging it out, and so instability is kind of, if you move to a higher grid, then it turns out maybe, the procedure simply might diverge at all.
Well, that's true. Well, analytic methods, certainly in certain problems, if you reduce the complexity, throw away most of the nonlinear terms, you can compare with analytical methods. But analytical methods only take you so far. You can't do, very complicated three-dimensional nonlinear, coupled nonlinear equations analytically with something that's, you think is realistic. So it's a different approach. And if these solutions had no resemblance to what we observe, the sun or the earth or the planets, we would stop doing them, I suppose. But I guess we're encouraged by the fact that we're getting something that looks something like what's observed, magnetic field reversals, for example. But we have to, you're right, we have to keep, be aware of the fact that these are very, very crude simulations. They're not, exact solutions to what we're trying to solve.
Is there any information or evidence as to what all these reversals of the magnetic fields or near reversals might have done to life on Earth?
Before I forget, if people are interested in reversals, and you mentioned that maybe the Earth's magnetic field today is heading towards a reversal. There is an article that I authored in Scientific American this month, April issue, if you're interested. The topic is magnetic field reversals, and some of the results here are in that article. But the question that, what has happened, it's reversed many, many times in the past, and it's going to reverse many times in the future. What happens, first of all, typically the intensity of the field decreases significantly. Mainly it's a dipole part of the field that decreases, and then the structure gets very complicated. But the magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field today, is shielding us partly, helping to shield us from cosmic radiation. The charged particles, mainly coming from the sun, charged particles, when there's a solar flare, like the movies I showed at the beginning of the talk, shoots out a large number of charged particles, electrons and protons mainly. And when they hit the Earth, if the Earth happens to be in that path, the particles will tend to spiral around the magnetic field lines. So that they sort of converge on the poles of the Earth, where very few people live, and sort of protect the low latitudes. So in that sense, the dipole structure of the Earth helps protect us against the high energy particles that could change our DNA or cause cancer or whatever. Although I have to mention, and a lot of people don't mention this, is that the Earth's atmosphere also is a big shield. A lot of these particles come in and hit the molecules in the Earth's atmosphere, and they become de-energized long before they hit the Earth, the surface of the Earth. So the atmosphere plays a major role there too. It's not like if the magnetic field were to go away that we'd be without a shield. But it would be, there is a concern that as the magnetic field continues to decrease, it's been decreasing for the last, since it's been measured accurately for the last couple hundred years, the intensity has been decreasing. And of course, when you see movies of this or science fiction movies of this, they tend to imply that it's decreasing very quickly and then something's going to happen within our lifetime. It's not going to happen that quickly. And I should also mention that the current intensity is only about the average. It's been high in the past. And it's been decreasing for the last, maybe more than several hundred thousand years, or more than a few hundred years. But it's only down to what sort of the average intensity is over the last several million years. So if it continues to decrease at the rate it's decreasing right now, if it continues for another 1,000 or 2,000 years, then maybe a reversal will start at that time. And the time it takes to reverse is another 4,000 or 5,000 years. So, I mean, we're talking about the distant future in terms of lifetimes. But if that all happens, there's just this, it's probably more likely that it's not going to reverse. It's going to keep decreasing, and then start increasing again. Remember the plot I showed of the intensity of the Earth's magnetic field? It goes up and down a lot, and only once in many, many times does it actually reverse. So just because it's decreasing now is not big news. It's either decreasing or increasing all the time. You know, it just happens to be decreasing right now, and it's not, you know, at a very low intensity yet. But it might. Maybe in 1,000 or a couple thousand years, it might start to reverse. But certainly by then, our computers will be fast enough, and we'll have studied the problem enough to understand it much better than we do today, and we'll be able to cope with it. We'll probably be on other planets by then. But it's happened many times in the past, and it hasn't caused, you know, large extinctions. People have looked to try to find correlations between extinctions or changes in species generation with reversals, and they don't see a close correlation. Maybe it's very subtle. Maybe it takes several thousand years or 10,000 years afterwards before you start seeing it, and it gets sort of smoothed out. It must have some effect because there's more cosmic radiation presumably coming in during a reversal, not only because the field's weaker, but because now the poles are not at the magnetic poles are not at the geographic poles, they're closer to the equator. So if anything, the magnetic field is focusing the radiation at low latitudes where a lot of life is. So it must have some effect on changing species. Some die away and others will start. But you know, I'm that's not my expertise. But it'll certainly happen again sometime in the future, but not in our lifetime.